new book, Loss of Faith, How the Air India Bombers Got Away with Murder, tells for the first time the full story of the Air India bombing, as well as its conspiracy and its aftermath. It's written by Kim Boland, the Vancouver Sun reporter who's covered the story for 20 years. Loss of Faith is a précis of who was involved, what precipitated the attack, how the author was involved herself in the story, and what has since happened since that terrorist attack of the 23rd of June, 1985, on that rancorous road for justice, a journey that, as of yet, is far from over. Kim Boland has won numerous awards for her work and has also received threats upon her life. The book is $36.99 Canadian, $27.95 American. It's published by McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome to thecommentary.ca Kim Boland. Good morning, Ms. Boland.
Good morning.
Does it feel like it's been 20 years for you?
Well, no, it doesn't. I think we can all look at our lives, you know, backwards in retrospect and feel that many things have happened that we didn't expect would happen. Certainly, I remember the night that this plane went down vividly. I was a young reporter sent off to the homes of family members who had lost loved ones, and it was an unbelievable experience to actually be welcomed into those homes by these grieving relatives when I had actually expected them to slam the door in my face. So, you know, sometimes it feels like the thing just happened yesterday, but certainly when I consider all the things that have gone on over the years, you know, problems that plague the criminal investigation, the loss of evidence, as we all have heard about, finally arrests that brought some hope to people, and then last March, the acquittals after almost 20 months of evidence. It's been a long road.
There's been a lot of talk about that evidence that was, I guess, erased, destroyed, that wasn't kept. Do you think that, you write in the book that had a lot of that evidence been kept, whatever that evidence contained, whatever the wiretaps contained, whatever those surveillance tapes contained, that would have had an effect on the verdict that was rendered this past spring. Do you think that it would have?
Well, definitely, if the erased wiretap tapes had been ruled admissible and allowed into evidence during that trial, it would have been another piece of the puzzle. These people were very savvy to the fact that they were being taped. They were being watched by Canada's fledgling spy agency, CSIS, at the time, and they were well aware of that. They talk in code. There are all kinds of little cryptic references that we know about from the notes of the tapes that were made at the time. So, you know, I don't know for sure if it would have turned the tide for this judge. It was a circumstantial case. It was a compelling circumstantial case. However, this judge ruled that a lot of things I thought made sense and supported the Crown's case didn't go far enough to convince him that these people were guilty. So, you know, I think it's possible that it could have made a difference, but we also have to remember that never in the history of this country have CSIS wiretaps been allowed into evidence in a criminal case, because CSIS has a much lower burden to meet in convincing a judge to give them authorization to get a wiretap. And so because CSIS has a mandate to collect intelligence and not pursue evidence in a criminal case, normally that wiretap information is not used in a criminal case. But I do know that the RCMP has said many times that it would have fought like crazy if it had had those tapes to get that admitted into this case.
I want for a moment just to go back for a little background on what precipitated the attacks. One of the things that I found interesting in reading the book, and I learned for the first time, is how this conflict, this Indian-based conflict for a separate Sikh state, came to Canada, came to British Columbia. How exactly did that happen? Was it because these people were the people that were involved with the bombing prominent in this community that they were able, and that they were wealthy, that they were able to fund this project, this terrorist attack?
Well, I think there were unique factors that existed in Canada that meant that this plot was hatched here as opposed to over in India. We had a large Sikh community in Canada, a community that at the time of this bombing had been here for 80 years, though largely under the radar of most Canadians. I think very few of us knew very much about Sikhism at the time, and I think that many of the Sikhs here had endured forms of racism over the years. You know, there were people from India who supported the separatist movement who came to Vancouver, who came to Toronto, and gave speeches, tried to raise some funds. They weren't really widely supported until June of 1984. At that point, the separatist leaders, the very militant people that were leading this movement in India, holed up inside the Golden Temple, Sikhism's holiest shrine, and they had amassed an arsenal there. Indira Gandhi, who was the Prime Minister of India at the time, was very concerned about what she viewed as a serious militant threat, and she sent the Indian Army into that temple, which was very ill-advised. She probably could have taken out the militants in a much less dramatic fashion, but instead we had images going around the world on television, in the newspapers, of tanks rolling into the sacred shrine and damaging it and killing not only the militants, but a lot of innocent pilgrims as well. So you had a great deal of reaction among Sikhs around the world. Most people protested peacefully, but there was a small group, a group that had already had sympathies for this movement, who decided to take very drastic measures to seek revenge. And that was plotting an attack on Air India, India's national airline. The goal had been to blow up two planes, and fortunately, one of the bombs exploded prematurely at Tokyo's Narita Airport, killing a couple of baggage handlers. Otherwise, we would have had two planes blown out of the sky on June 23rd, 1985.
Now, how did the people that CSIS and the RCMP were following prior to the June 23rd bombing, how were they tagged by, I mean, what precipitated them being followed by CSIS? Was it something they did? Was it this support for radical Sikhism?
Well, I think there were different factors. CSIS had only existed for a few months at the time. It had sort of spun off from the RCMP, which used to have a wing that did intelligence gathering and had always faced a number of controversies, and that resulted in new legislation that created CSIS. CSIS had received information from many sources, people in the Indo-Canadian community who knew that some of these people were fairly extremist in their views and were talking quite openly about advocating violence, albeit in the Punjabi language, at different events. They also received information from the Indian government that Air India could be a target. There was no secret made of the fact that Air India, you know, had been on a list, a watch list, that these militants had been talking about, at the very least boycotting it and more seriously attacking one of the flights. So all this information trickled in from a variety of sources. In March of 1985, 3 months before the bombing, CSIS got permission from a court to wiretap the phone of Talvinder Singh Parmar. This man has been accepted as the mastermind of this plot. He lived in the Vancouver suburb of Burnaby, and he has since been killed, so he never faced a trial like the other accused men did. So CSIS was watching him, they were following him around, and they were making tapes of his phone calls, but they didn't have anybody capable of listening to those tapes on staff, nobody who spoke the Punjabi language, and as a result, the tapes weren't listened to in most cases until after the bombing, and even then, these little notes were made and the tapes were routinely destroyed.
One of the things we've heard about for years now from victims' families is that an inquiry should be held. You just mentioned the inability for the processing of these tapes and getting them translated. Would an inquiry, do you think, at this point, it would lay blame to people that perhaps deserve it? Would that accomplish anything, do you think, and would that provide the families the closure that they so desperately need?
Well, I don't think that even if there were convictions back in March, there would be closure for these family members. They have fought with unbelievable grace and dignity for 20 years for justice. They have not received that justice, and they will continue to fight on. Even the two men who were charged were never the only suspects in this plot. There are other people who live in Vancouver, who live in British Columbia, who are walking around to this day and have never even spent a day in jail in connection with their suspected role in this mass murder, this unprecedented mass murder. But an inquiry would allow us, all Canadians, to look at some of the systemic failings the failings of CSIS, the failings of the RCMP. We also have some political issues in regard to this case. We know that many politicians of all stripes have had associations with some of these suspects over the years. Perhaps they didn't understand who they were dealing with, but they have cozied up to some of the most militant people within the Sikh community who are in the minority, but who have been very successful at turning people out for nomination meetings come election time. And there are a lot of people very concerned about the optics of the relationship between some politicians and some of these militants and their supporters. That's something else that could be looked at a public inquiry. So I don't think it would bring, you know, justice in the sense of people going to jail for participating in this act of terrorism. But I think that a public inquiry could answer questions, and we have far too many questions right now surrounding this case that don't have answers.
You titled the book Loss of Faith, and that applies to a lot of things. So an inquiry, do you think, would restore some faith that we've lost as Canadians in our justice system?
I think that it would, and I don't think that all the questions would necessarily be answered, but it would go some distance in bringing about answers. And, you know, we always talk about all the family members. Obviously, they have lost the most in this. However, I think all Canadians should be really concerned that an act of terrorism of this magnitude was able to unfold in the first place under the eye of these law enforcement agencies that couldn't quite figure out what was going on, and that it went unprosecuted for 15 years, and then once charges were laid, there was no successful prosecution. We should all be troubled by that. And, you know, you see the public inquiry having just taken place in the David Milgaard case. You know, there was one man who was inappropriately charged and convicted 36 years ago. We know who the real killer is in that case. The real killer was eventually caught and put in jail. Mr. Milgaard was released, and he received compensation for his time in prison. There aren't that many unanswered questions, and yet 36 years later, there's still a public inquiry in that case. Surely the deaths of 331 people, where nobody has been successfully convicted of plotting, we should have a public inquiry.
We're talking with Kim Bolan from the Vancouver Sun and the author of a new book, Loss of Faith, How the Air India Bombers Got Away with Murder, $36.99 from McClelland and Stewart. One of the people that you write about throughout the book is Tara Singh Hare. He was a friend of yours. You talk about, he was once for a separate Sikh state, but eventually he turned around on that when he saw that there was great violence that was used by some of these militants. You call that a political evolution on his part. Where has the desire for a separate Sikh state gone, and has that dissipated, do you think?
Well, I think when Air India exploded, when there were other acts of terrorism both in Canada and India linked to a very small group of extremists within the separatist movement, the movement was really discredited. And in India, by and large, it was crushed in 1992, rather brutally, in fact, by the head of the Punjab police there at the time, a man named K.P.S. Gill, who some revere today for his ability to deal with that, and who others think should be thrown in jail for human rights violations. So there isn't a lot of widespread support for this movement. However, there still are some in Canada within the Sikh community who will talk about Khalistan and talk about the need for having a separate Sikh nation. By and large, around the world, however, there's very little support for it. And when I was back in India just before the trial began, I was somewhat of an expert on this movement. People in Punjab had largely forgotten all about it.
Let's move on to the trial now. One of the fascinating figures that you got to know was Rani Kumar. That's not her real name. She was the star witness for the Crown. Why wasn't her testimony believed? And you allege that it was sexism on the part of the judge in small measure?
Well, yes. This is a person I got to know very well as a source who everything she ever told me I was able to independently verify as accurate. So I certainly had a different context when I was listening to her evidence and the judge did. And, you know, in addition to that, I also know that she began to get very serious threats against her life and against the life of her family. When stories were being published in my newspaper that some believe she was a source for at the time, this woman was eventually whisked away into the witness protection program. That came within a couple of weeks of my house being shot at in connection with this. Messages threatening myself being left on my voicemail at work. There was rumors of a hit list circulating that had my name on it, Tara Hare's name on it, her name on it. So I believed her because I saw what she went through and because everything she ever told me I was able to prove was true. So I found it quite disturbing that the judge said he didn't believe her. One of the main reasons he cited was the fact that when she testified, she said she still loved Rupudaman Singh Malik, one of the two men accused who was acquitted last March. Mr. Malik had been very close to her. She worked with him at this parochial school in a suburb of Vancouver. And the judge said that no one could claim to remain in love with somebody who had confessed to mass murder. So I found that very simplistic, almost a Dr. Phil analysis that I don't think he was capable of giving, of people's very complex emotions when they're dealing with somebody who they've been close to. You know, we know from, all kinds of research that has been done that, there are all kinds of women who go into jails and actually marry people after they know they're serial killers or whatever. So I found that one a little bit bizarre. And, there were other things as well. He accepted that she was just an ex-employee with a grudge. But that didn't wash because she had ruined her own life to testify in this case. She was forced to give up a very good job that she had. One of her two children did not go with her into the witness protection program. Her marriage broke up as a result of going into witness protection. And once she was there, she was not able to have a normal life. As anybody in that program can tell you, it is not a pleasant experience. And I thought her testimony was very, very vivid and believable in that regard. And yet the judge still said that he didn't think she was telling the truth.
You mentioned being threatened in the course of this story. You've been honored by your peers for your work on this story, and you've also received threats as a result of the case. Looking back at the past 20 years and everything that's happened to you, do you hold any bitterness or anger to anyone involved in this case?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, certainly I've had my moments of frustration, as have a lot of people in connection with this. A number of the people who came forward as witnesses, not just Rani, but others, received threatening phone calls, had their houses shot at or attacked. And, it's frustrating when you see those kinds of things going on and they've gone unprosecuted for so many years. I think a climate was allowed to brew within this community where a certain segment believed they could do anything and get away with it, whether that was bombing an airline and killing hundreds of people or whether that was threatening some moderates within their own community who tried to do something about the extremist violence. So it's certainly frustrating when you look back at all those things. We talked about Tara Hare. Tara Hare finally agreed to give the RCMP a statement in regards to Air India, saying that the other man charged, Ajab Singh Bagri, had confessed in front of a number of people in England late in 1985 and that Mr. Hare had been present for that confession. So here's a guy who risked a lot. He was first shot in 1988 and paralyzed, and he was assassinated in 1998 within a few months of me getting a letter at my newspaper saying that I would be killed and he would be killed if I didn't stop writing about Mr. Malik, one of the two men eventually charged. So, looking back, there's frustration without a doubt. How could this guy who had received so many threats, who was on a witness list, end up getting assassinated? And his murder remains unsolved. Maybe that's a good thing now because it gives the police another opportunity to shed some light on the Air India case if there are charges laid in his murder.
You talk about having some frustration over last 20 years. Do you have any regrets at all about the way that you've covered this story?
Well, I think that obviously you reflect all the time when, you know, you cover something that is controversial, that is difficult subject matter. And, you know, without a doubt, there are certain stories I might have wished I'd handled differently or, you know, proceeded differently on at the time. But I don't really have any regrets. I think I did what I felt I had to do as a journalist. I had unbelievable support from my newspaper right from the very beginning and throughout the last 20 years. And I wish things had come out differently in the trial. I wish there had been convictions and there weren't convictions. You know, but overall, I think that my reporting and the reporting of others has made a difference. And I think that's all you can hope for as a journalist.
And did it trouble you that you got involved in it somehow, that you were drawn into it, into the story?
Well, you don't like to become involved in a story because as a reporter, you know, you want to be this person standing back and observing. But, you know, we've seen this in other cases in Canada. Michelle Auger in Quebec, who was covering the Hells Angels and other motorcycle gangs with such vigor that he ended up being targeted and shot and fortunately survived an assassination attempt. So I think when you're covering things, dealing with dangerous people, frightening people, criminal organizations or terrorist groups, you sometimes end up being drawn into the story against your will, but you're there and that's part of the role you end up playing.
We had Jeffrey Gall on before, right after the verdict was rendered, before they announced that they weren't going to appeal the decision. And he gave us an explanation as to errors in law versus fact. You talked about Rani Kumar's testimony in the book. You also talked about this plaza that was supposedly in front of the temple that the judge says wasn't there, but obviously was there through the pictures in your newspaper. Obviously, that's a frustration on the part of a reader of your book, a concerned citizen, to say the least. Where do we go from here? What happens now with this case? And obviously, the Crown won't appeal. Is an inquiry the next step?
Well, an inquiry is certainly one step that would help bring about additional answers. It's not the only one. As I mentioned, there are some parallel criminal cases. The Tara Hare murder investigation has been ramped up. I know police are working very hard. They have lots of ideas about who was involved and who was responsible. And I think without a doubt, Mr. Hare was murdered because of information he had with regard to the Air India investigation. So, you know, if we see charges laid in that, we may get some additional answers. We also have the possibility of investigative hearings. This is a provision in the new anti-terrorism law that came about after the 9/11 attacks. Police are able to bring forth suspects or others with knowledge of any terrorist plot and force them to answer questions in a court of law in front of a judge. It's not a criminal proceeding, but the information that they're compelled to give can be used in an eventual criminal proceeding. So, you know, there are a few things that are continuing, but obviously the best shot at justice was that criminal case, and that is now behind us and gone.
Finally, Kim Boland, what's the reaction been to the book since it's come out? It's been out for a month or so now. What have people said who've read the book about your work?
Well, I think, you know, the reaction has generally been very positive. There's lots of new information in the book that I think helps explain to people, helps connect the dots, if you will, in a very complex case that, because it's gone on for 20 years, is very difficult for any journalist to convey the background story in one news story in a newspaper, on television or radio. So I think that the book allows people to understand much more fully what happened before this bombing, what happened after this bombing, and what's going on still today in connection with this very small group of people suspected of hatching this plot and carrying it out.
That you haven't heard from either families or from those sympathetic to Mr. Malik or Mr. Becker?
Oh, no, I have heard from both parties, definitely. I was on a book tour and met with family members in Ottawa, in the Toronto area, in Montreal, and other members of the Indo-Canadian community have received the book very well. I was very careful to point out repeatedly throughout the book that, you know, this terrorist attack had nothing to do with Sikhism. You know, I think that's something or misconception that Canadians have. The people who are believed to have done it may call themselves, you know, Orthodox or religious Sikhs, but this religion does not justify this. And Sikhism and the Sikh community have unfairly been linked to this case since June 23, 1985. So I tried to show how many within that community had been the ones standing up with great vigor to the suspects over the years and what they had faced as repercussion for their actions trying to get justice in this case.
Kim Bolan, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been fascinating to talk to you and to read this book.
Thanks for having me on.
And I do appreciate it. It's a remarkable book if for the overview that it gives of a very complicated case and from someone who knows the story very well from the beginning. And it's one that's far from finished, obviously. The book is called Loss of Faith, How the Air India Bombers Got Away with Murder, $36.99 Canadian, published by McClelland and Stewart for the commentary.ca.